This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 4th of April, these are our main stories. Donald Trump is in New York ahead of his court appearance later today, with the city's mayor warning that what he called rabble-rousers should control their fury. Moscow has blamed Ukraine and Russian opposition activists for the bomb attack that killed a prominent pro-war blogger in St. Petersburg. And the Kenyan authorities have dropped charges against four opposition MPs after their leader called off protests against the government. Also in this podcast, that unmistakable French song, and the Paris home of the composer Serge Gainsbourg is going to be open to the public later this year. The former US President Donald Trump appears in court in New York later today. He'll face criminal charges linked to a payment to buy the silence of a porn star just before the 2016 election. With increased security measures in place ahead of expected protests, the city's mayor, Eric Adams, issued a warning to what he termed rabble-rousers who are thinking of travelling to New York for the court appearance.
Our message is clear and simple. Control yourselves. New York City is our home, not a playground for your misplaced anger. We are the safest large city in America because we respect the rule of law in New York City.
Full details of the charges against Mr. Trump will only come out in court. Media organisations have asked that cameras be allowed in the courtroom, something that doesn't usually happen in New York. Mr. Trump arrived in the city on Monday from his Mar-a-Lago home in Florida. He stayed the night in his Trump Tower property and is the first former US president to be criminally indicted. Our correspondent Neda Taufik spent Monday evening outside Trump Tower.
Outside, there are visible security preparations that have been put in place, police buses, barricades. But interestingly, they didn't close down any streets here in Manhattan as Donald Trump's motorcade made its way here from LaGuardia Airport. There were a few of his supporters outside holding Trump 2024 banners because, of course, he will be going to court not just as a defendant, but as a potential nominee for the Republicans in the presidential race in 2024. But there were also those who celebrated this moment, those opposed to the president. So quite a busy atmosphere here by Trump Tower, as well down at the courthouse.
That was Neda Taufik in New York. Well, Yalda Hakim spoke to Anthony Scaramucci, who was briefly the White House communications director during the Trump presidency. So does he think this court appearance of Donald Trump is a test of U.S. democracy?
Let's see what the case is. If it's merely about Stormy Daniels and the other Playboy model, I would tell you that would have been a bad decision. I don't think anybody that believes in the rule of law and the pillars of the democracy and the fairness between adversarial political parties would go down the road of indicting somebody for that. But if it's broader than that, let's see what the case is. You know, apparently there are 34 other charges that are going to be rendered. We've got to get a look at that, of course. But I don't like it. I've been very clear about that. But I don't think my disliking it and the what it does to the rule of law and what it causes into question here in the United States, that doesn't mean that Mr. Trump is the right guy or should be president again. We have to work against him because it would be a very difficult prospect for the world.
The other point is you don't have to have a clean criminal record to hold office in the United States.
No, you could ask my old professor, Alan Dershowitz, you could technically run the country from a jail cell. And by the way, as you know from your history, jail cells have a tendency to empower political leaders. I'm just pointing out that we have examples in history where jailing a political leader actually makes them more powerful, not less powerful. So I'm not in love with it. I don't like it. I'd like to beat Mr. Trump on the merits. I'd like to beat him in the intellectual marketplace, the free marketplace of ideas. I don't like what they're going to do, but it doesn't take away from the fact that he should never be president again.
That was Anthony Scaramucci. The Russian authorities have blamed Ukrainian intelligence and Russian opposition activists for the bombing that killed a prominent pro-war blogger in a St. Petersburg cafe on Sunday. They've also detained a Russian woman as a suspect in the case. In a video released by investigators, 26-year-old Daria Trepova appears to admit handing over the statuette, which later exploded, killing the blogger Vladlen Tatarsky. She doesn't say she knew it would explode. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described what happened as a terrorist act.
The active phase of the investigation is underway now. We see quite vigorous steps to detain the suspect. The data, judging from the National Anti-Terrorism Committee, indicating that Ukrainian special services may be involved in the planning of this terrorist attack. And this is, of course, a terrorist attack.
Ms. Trepova has previously been detained for protesting against the invasion of Ukraine. More than 30 people were injured in the attack. From Moscow, Will Vernon reports.
Vladlen Tatarsky gained particular notoriety last year when he filmed himself in the Kremlin delivering a message to Russia's enemies. We will defeat everyone. We will kill everyone. We will rob everyone as necessary. Footage played on Russian TV shows Mr. Tatarsky in the moments shortly before the blast that killed him. It appears that the blogger had been given a statuette. Reports suggest that the explosives were hidden inside. Russian investigators say they have detained a 26-year-old local woman, Daria Trepova, on suspicion of involvement in the bombing. Friends say she holds anti-war views and is an active supporter of Russian opposition groups. In a video released by Russian police, Ms. Trepova appears to admit that she did take the statuette to the cafe, although the BBC can't be sure that she didn't make those comments under duress. It is not clear to what extent she is a suspect in the investigation, or whether she knew what was really inside the statuette. Russia's Anti-Terrorism Committee has accused Ukrainian intelligence agencies of planning the bombing. This is denied by Kyiv. Russian investigators have also said Ms. Trepova was a supporter of Alexei Navalny, the jailed opposition leader whose organization was banned and labeled as extremist in Russia. It is not yet clear who was responsible for the attack, but the bombing will make many ordinary Russians nervous. This is the latest in a string of explosions and drone attacks on Russian territory in recent months. When Vladimir Putin launched his special military operation in February last year, he said it was necessary to protect Russians. But for many people here, the war is now getting worryingly close.
That was Will Vernon in Russia. The Alexei Navalny Foundation has denied any involvement in the bombing. A spokesman said it was very convenient for the Kremlin to blame its critics. Finland joins the NATO alliance today. The country, which has a border of nearly 1,300 kilometres with Russia, began the application process following Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Its membership was ratified last week. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said both NATO and Finland would be stronger as a result of the move. Here's our World Affairs correspondent, Paul Adams.
This has been a rapid process. Finland only said it wanted to join NATO last year. In Brussels, its flag will be raised at NATO headquarters. For the organisation's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, it's a moment to savour.
This is a historic week. We will welcome Finland as the 31st member of NATO, making Finland safer and our alliance stronger.
Before Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year, Vladimir Putin said he wanted NATO to pull back from Eastern Europe and halt the process of expansion. Now, Mr. Stoltenberg says, the exact opposite is happening. With Finland's accession, Russia's border with NATO will more than double. The Baltic Sea, home to two major Russian ports, will become even more part of NATO's backyard, a process that'll be complete when Sweden joins, probably in the coming months. That's being held up by another alliance member, Turkey, which says Sweden still hasn't done enough to crack down on Kurdish militants living there. Until recently, Finland faced similar Turkish objections. Mr. Stoltenberg said he was confident all differences would be resolved in time for this summer's NATO summit in Lithuania. Moscow says it plans to strengthen its forces in northwestern Russia to confront what it sees as a threatening move by NATO. If the alliance went further and deployed troops and equipment in Finland, then Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said the Kremlin was willing to take what he called additional steps.
That was Paul Adams. China stakes a claim to much of the South China Sea. Other countries disagree, making for great political tension, not least because of the huge oil and gas reserves there are in the region. Now, though, Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim says he's ready to negotiate with Beijing on the issue. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow has been looking at what that might mean.
Well, we don't know the details about exactly what he's prepared to negotiate, but the fact he's prepared to negotiate, and that's the interesting bit. He went to China, this is Mr. Anwar, last week. He spoke to Xi Jinping, China's leader, and he came back and he said essentially that it's Malaysia's territory, this area which is under discussion, but he's willing to talk to China about their claims over that region as well. Really an indication of just how powerful China is, that he doesn't agree with the Malaysian Prime Minister, doesn't agree with them, but he feels that he has no option but to talk to them.
And in the meantime, there has also been a development involving China, this time with the Philippines. Tell us about that.
There has, yes. This is the Philippines shifting its gaze from China more towards the United States. Under a previous president, the Philippines had aligned itself somewhat with Beijing. But under the current president, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., they moved back towards the United States. And today, the Philippines announced the names of four military bases where it will be allowing US troops and machinery to pass through and be stored. Interestingly, two of these are in the north of the Philippines, facing Taiwan, another potential flashpoint between China and the United States, and one will be in the south of the Philippines facing the South China Sea, another area of dispute. It's also worth mentioning as well that today the US House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has confirmed that he's going to meet Tsai Ing-wen. This is a Taiwanese president. He's going to meet her in California as she travels back from Central America to Taiwan. This is another development involving the geopolitical struggle between America and China.
So talk to us about the thread that's weaving through all of these developments.
It's a good way to put it. It is a thread. I think what all of this says is that it's a region in flux where all the little countries in this area realise that they don't want to take sides, they don't want to take China's side, they don't want to take America's side, but they realise that there's threats potentially from both areas and they're hedging their bets in many respects. It's a region in flux. It's also a region in which no country can afford to ignore either side.
That was our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow. Still to come, NASA has announced the crew members for its Artemis II mission.
We need to celebrate this moment in human history. It is the next step on the journey that gets humanity to Mars.
We'll be right back after this.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service that seeks out extraordinary stories from around the globe.
I'm in a trench in Ukraine with shells flying overhead, petrified.
It's a window into other people's worlds.
It can't be separated from the addictive nature of my personality.
And it's available now.
Feeling incredibly alive when death was at its closest.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now back to the Global News podcast and to Kenya, where charges have been dropped against four opposition MPs. It comes a day after the opposition leader Raila Odinga suspended protests and agreed to hold talks with President William Ruto. Here's Will Ross.
The dropping of the charges against the four opposition MPs is a sign that Kenya's feuding politicians are working towards at least trying some form of dialogue. Both President William Ruto and Raila Odinga suggested over the weekend that they were ready to talk. By suspending the protests, Mr. Odinga has reduced some of the political tension, and Mr. Ruto helped with some reconciliatory comments and must know there's a danger of more widespread unrest if protests resume. The opposition leader's refusal to accept that he lost last year's election may still be a stumbling block, and it feels like a critical moment for Kenya's stability.
Will Ross. NASA has revealed the names of the astronauts, three Americans and one Canadian, who will fly on a mission around the moon late next year or early 2025. The launch of Artemis 2 is part of preparations for mankind to walk again on the lunar surface for the first time in more than half a century. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos has the details.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Artemis 2 crew.
To great fanfare, the boss of NASA, Bill Nelson, introduced each of the astronauts in turn. This is a new generation trying to recapture the excitement and daring do of a past era. Not since the Apollo missions, which ended in 1972, have humans been anywhere near the moon, let alone set foot on it. Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Koch and Jeremy Hansen are part of NASA's new exploration project it calls Artemis. The upcoming flight may only be a loop around the moon, but for Victor Glover, the first ever African-American to be picked for a lunar mission, it signals an even grander ambition.
We need to celebrate this moment in human history, because Artemis 2 is more than a mission to the moon and back. It's more than a mission that has to happen before we send people to the surface of the moon. It is the next step on the journey that gets humanity to Mars.
The Artemis program was initiated last year with an unpiloted test of a huge new rocket and a capsule. If all goes well with this next Artemis outing, a follow-up crew will be chosen to attempt a landing, potentially in 2025, although NASA has yet to develop all of the equipment it needs to make a touchdown possible.
Jonathan Amos. Well, Julian Marshall spoke to Leroy Chow, a former NASA astronaut and commander of the International Space Station. He's a veteran of four spaceflights.
This is a big moment, of course. Finally, we're getting closer to launching astronauts on the new SLS rocket and the Orion spacecraft, and for the first time in over 50 years, to hopefully launch this crew around the moon.
Is it something that you would have wanted to do during your astronaut's career?
I was inspired by the Apollo program, and in particular the Apollo 11 moon landing. I was 8 years old when we landed on the moon for the first time, and that's what started the dream for me to want to try to become an astronaut myself. So to have had a chance to go to the moon would have been fantastic, but obviously the timing, which I had no control over, didn't work out for me. And so, but I, at the same time, I can't complain. I had the richest flying career that I could have had for being in the program at the time that I was.
I mean, the mission is at least a year away. From your experience of being in space, what's this period like for the astronauts? You're named for the mission, but it's going to be some time before you actually undertake it.
They're going to be plenty busy doing training and other kinds of events. Typically for space shuttle missions, crews were assigned anywhere from 1 to 2 years before the actual flight. And in the case of my first space flight, we were about 2 years out from the actual launch date. So this is not that unusual. In fact, when you're training for your first space station mission, because of all the requirements, training not only on the American side, but also on the Russian side, all the travel training in Canada for the robotics, language training. Typically, it's at least 3.5 years of training before you actually go fly to the space station for the first time. So this having to wait maybe around 2 years, year and a half, 2 years, not atypical, and they're going to be busy every day.
Leroy Chow, a former NASA astronaut. Britain's former finance minister, Nigel Lawson, who served as Chancellor of the Exchequer under Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, has died aged 91. Sean Lay assesses his legacy.
Nigel Lawson was a Chancellor who took risks. Some were spectacularly successful, helping the Conservatives win the 1987 election. But his stewardship of the economy also helped fuel recession. A talented financial journalist, he was ideally suited to run the Treasury, and Margaret Thatcher put him in charge in 1983. He cut income tax, boosted share ownership, and paid off government debt. But lower taxes, together with cheaper borrowing, fuelled an unsustainable boom. Interest rates rose sharply, and Britain went into recession. Although Mrs. Thatcher called Nigel Lawson unassailable, he resigned in 1989 after falling out with her over Europe, an issue which would contribute to her own departure a year later.
Sean Lay on the life of Britain's former finance minister Nigel Lawson, who's died aged 91. Now, a couple of editions ago, we told you about the world's biggest oil exporters announcing a surprise cut in production, and now oil prices have surged. The price of Brent crude oil jumped more than 5% to $84 a barrel. The price of oil soared in February 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine, but it's now back at levels seen before the conflict. More details from Samir Hashmi.
Oil prices rose after Saudi Arabia, Iraq and several Gulf states announced on Sunday that they were cutting production by more than 1 million barrels of oil a day. In addition, Russia said it will extend its cut of 500,000 barrels per day until the end of the year. The reduction in oil output is being made by members of OPEC+. The group accounts for about 40% of the world's crude oil supplies. Analysts have warned that higher oil prices could make it harder to bring down the cost of living.
Samir Hashmi. The earliest known full recording of a live Beatles concert has been revealed by BBC Radio, almost exactly 60 years after the performance. The group played for an hour at Stowe Boarding School in Buckinghamshire on the 4th of April 1963, a month after the release of their debut album, Please Please Me. Tickets were sold to pupils to raise the fee of £100. The concert itself was secretly recorded by one of the boys, John Bloomfield, who was 15 at the time. And he told the BBC's Front Row programme it was a life-changing experience.
Having no clue what was about to happen, and then the curtains went back and they started, and despite the fact you can see there are relatively small amplification, for us that was enormously loud. And I would say I grew up at that very instant. I mean, it sounds a bit an exaggeration, but I realised this was something from a different planet. And it wasn't till they started playing that we heard the screaming and we realised we were in the middle of Beatlemania. It was just something we'd never even vaguely experienced.
Beatles fan John Bloomfield. And staying with a musical theme, you might remember this. The unmistakable sound of Je t'aime moi non plus, of course. Its composer, singer-songwriter Serge Gainsbourg, died in 1991. And from later this year, fans will be able to visit his home in Paris. The house on the city's left bank has been left largely untouched for more than 30 years. The walls outside have been a site of pilgrimage for admirers of his work. As well as his home, there'll be a museum and a piano bar. Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, explained just what a significant figure he was.
Extremely important figure in French music from the 60s onwards, or even before, right through to his death in 1991. He was the preeminent figure, not just for what he did musically, but also because of his character, of the way he kind of dominated the culture, particularly in the 70s and 80s. He started off back in the sort of immediate post-war years as a very kind of piano-playing chansonneur who would go around the cabarets and wrote songs for people like Edith Piaf and so on. But by the end, in the 70s and 80s, he was a rocker, he's a rock star, you know. And in between, he'd become the writer of big pop hits. The French loved him because he had this, as I said, this highly provocative side as well. He was an incredibly intelligent person as well as being a great musician, and loved nothing better than to kind of rile the establishment and to send them up. He would not survive today because he was very provocative and did things which would just not be acceptable today. But at the time, everyone loved him, and when he died, it felt like a national tragedy.
Now, he died in 1991, didn't he? What will visitors now find in his house/museum?
Well, this is all very interesting because no one's been in there, you know, since he died, and it is a time capsule, we're told. Individuals have been in. His daughter, Charlotte Gainsbourg, the actress Jane Birkin's daughter, owns the house and has had this dream to turn it into something, but she didn't know what. And for the first years, it was all too raw. And then she went off to New York to work and live. But now she came back a few years ago and resuscitated this idea. Then COVID came along. Meanwhile, the house has been barely changed, we're told, to the point that there are the same cigarettes in the ashtrays that he'd smoked the night before he died. So we're told. I mean, I suspect some of this is slightly folkloric and urban myth. But I mean, in general, it's true. It is a time capsule. It's the building that he lived in from 69, I think, up to 91, with all the strange Dali-esque decor that he had there, all the rooms painted black, for example, with all his knickknacks, a collection of dolls, portraits of Brigitte Bardot, his lover, of course, at one point. What I've read is that it's been a real architectural problem to design a kind of museum or a kind of a place to visit, because it's actually quite small.
That was Hugh Schofield in Paris. And now it's time for us to say au revoir, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you will also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.